How are you?
So we have four.
That's cool.
Yep, it is four. Well, I'll call it. It is 5:32 according to my clock, so let's go ahead and call the meeting to order and have roll call. Please.
I'm Ed Tadeo. Annabelle Nunez.
Present.
Michelle Un.
Present.
Tracy Hockett. Martha Lemon.
Present.
And we have quorum with that.
All righty. Okay, on to item number two. Oh, by the way, thank you everyone for being here in person.
Thank you.
Gosh, lost my manners. All right, item number two, approval of the legal action report and minutes from the December 20th meeting since we canceled the meeting in January. Do I have a...
I'll make a motion to approve.
I'll second.
Thank you. We have a motion by Kate Calhoun to approve the legal action report and a second, and minutes, and a second from Martha Lemon. Roll call, please.
I'm Ed Tadeo.
Aye.
Annabelle Nunez.
Aye.
Kate Calhoun.
Aye.
Tracy Hockett.
Aye.
And Martha Lemon.
Aye.
Yeah, we're going to let you, Tracy, settle in. How's that sound? Thanks for being here, Lucy. It's great to see you. Yes, we're going to give you a minute.
You just go listen and then approve the meeting minutes. That's fine.
Oops. They look good. Okay. Item number three, a report from me, the chair. I don't really have a whole lot to report. Not much has happened by way of much. No trainings have been happening. I think we just, now that we're having the opportunity to meet in person, we're going to have elections. Hopefully we'll have a new chair representing CPARB this year, and kind of get back to the business of being able to connect with community, maybe do some ride-alongs with police officers, some of the alternative training other than some of the training that we've had in the last year or so. But other than that, I don't have a whole lot of other informational items for agenda item number three. So, fast forward quickly to item number four, call to the audience. At this time, the community may address the board with their concerns. The board may not address the specific concerns at this meeting. However, the board may, at its discretion, make it a future agenda item in which it can be discussed. As the community members are asked to address the board, not a specific member. Each person has a limit. And that should actually say 3 minutes, because we had changed that. But that was my chair decision. I don't know if that's going to change, but we did limit it to 3 minutes once upon a time. Okay, since nobody is here, we'll move on to item number five. Moving right along, review of the TPD investigations. In accordance with Section 10A-88F of the Mayor and Council mandate, the board may only review those charges specified in the investigation in order to comment on the fairness and thoroughness of the internal investigation and to report any concerns regarding that investigation to those specified in the mandate. These cases were given to us in January, so we're just going to go ahead and proceed to review them this evening, the first one being case number 21-0416. This one, folks, I'm sorry, it was a pretty difficult case to sort of review. I wish had additional information to kind of give people fair warning about the cases that I get, but I don't get a lot of annotation of what the cases actually entail in detail, so I wouldn't have that kind of information to just kind of give people a heads up. So, you know, I just want to apologize. I know it was difficult to review. Having said that, thank you for taking the time to do that. Okay, so this one, please tell me I reviewed. I brought my right notes. Yeah, all right, I'm going to have to go off the top of my head. Grab the wrong ones. So, case 04-210416. Oh my gosh.
Motorcycle.
Can relay some notes that I took.
Yeah,
about it.
The allegations were death declaration, which is
particular and specific.
I don't have the number in front of me. I apologize, y'all. Man, I printed the wrong ones out. Okay. Thank you so much. All right. So the allegations was 700, and it was policy procedure, which was sustained, and it was the actions was that it was found at the yellow on the discipline chart. The other one, and this was for one officer, that's Hoffman. The other allegation was 503, and that was pertaining to evidence. That was also sustained, and this was also inclusive as the action item for yellow. And the other allegation was 201, failure to take appropriate action. Then for Officer Escamilla, also, the allegation was the allegation was policy procedure, and that was also sustained. And in this case, it was found to be the action on the blue, on the discipline, and also 201, failure to take appropriate action. Then for Officer Frank Utter, 700, that was also sustained at the blue, and 503 on evidence that was not found to be in violation, nor was 201, which was failure to take appropriate action. And then Officer Brendan Weiberg on policy and procedure, it was sustained on the action was yellow on the discipline thermometer, and then 207 was failure to take appropriate action, also sustained. So essentially, in this case, there was a motorcycle accident where there was an individual. It was a fatal accident. An individual was called deceased in the roadway, and it seems to me that there was a number of folks from different agencies on site, and there was a call declaring the individual dead by one of the officers. The officer, Escamilla, was training. It seems to me he was about 2 months in, still sort of in training mode, and made a call that he had actually felt a pulse on the individual. Then I think it was a member from another agency who was sort of correcting and saying, you're not doing it correctly, etc. And then there was questions about the body worn camera not being on, and then asking the officer as to why it wasn't turned on when the individual's property was being, or identification of the individual was being searched. Anyone want to add anything? I don't want to have you hear my voice all night on this one. This was a long one. Anything to add?
To the synopsis? Or
sure. Or yeah, just in general.
So I definitely have comments and questions. Are we there yet?
Is that enough as to not? Is that jog enough of people's memory in case it was, because I know you all waited, hopefully we didn't generate. All right, yeah, so I'll open it up for discussion.
All right. Well, So this one was definitely a long read, for sure. And initially, looking at it, it looks like the TPD officers on site suffered through rookie mistakes. So it's looking, how long have they been there? No, it's not a rookie mistake that they did. But there was, it seemed a little bit of chaos from when the TPD arrived. They arrived on scene, Pima County Sheriff was there, CPD was there, and the TFD was pulling out. So given all of that, how do you guys decide who's in charge? Because it seems like there was a lapse in leadership of who's taking charge of the scene, and that part of it is understood. TPD was there, they can declare death. I could see how some things were thought of, but who's in charge when multiple agencies come on board? And then, kind of related, does TPD have access to whatever notes PCSO developed? Because it seems like they declared death, TPD relied on that information, but that might have been an error. So how come protocol was breached with declaring death inappropriately? That's one question. And
do you want,
other
do you
associated.
Want to, do you want to let them answer that one first?
There's a bunch of related, so it's
okay.
Like
okay.
What's on my mind.
Okay.
The level of training for first aid and CPR, is it a high enough level for responding officers to be able to determine the pulse accurately and know the subtleties of maybe getting a false reading? And part of that, it's like looking at the unfortunate motorcyclist, there was a description of blood at his head, but if it was blood coming out of his head, that means his heart is beating. He's still alive. So are officers able to discern that kind of level of first aid and all of that? So I'm harping on that because it just seems like initially it was a little bit chaotic on the scene that seemed to sort itself out, but a couple of officers got reprimanded. So leadership, who's in charge? And even within TBD, is it like first one who arrives, are they it? How is leadership determined? And that's it for now.
So I'll answer some basics. Lieutenant Dillo, so is this yours? Okay, so I'm not familiar with the case. I came over, I think, in July, and it has not come through me. So I can't tell you about like the dynamics on the scene, that particular scene. I can answer overall leadership's. The incident commander is how we define it, and that's normally the first officer on scene. That can be transferred over, so depending on if senior officers get there, senior leadership, sergeant, lieutenant, all the way up. But prior to being transferred over, they have to provide a briefing to the person they're transferring leadership to, like, this is what I have, questions need to be answered, et cetera, before someone else would assume as the commander. So it's normally the first one on scene, the one that has the most information, eyes on. You can't take incident commander while you're driving there. You have to be on the scene and have eyes on the scene. So that's how that works. So first aid, and I only know this because prior to becoming assistant chief over patrol, I was assigned to the academy. There's been various levels of first aid training, obviously, depending on officers over the years. What we found was that that has not been maintained, and obviously with first aid, it's changed over the years. You know, where you get a pulse and how long you need to have a pulse and certain signs. So we just did last year, the second half of last year, we just did an updated first aid training for the entire department. So anyone who got training 10 years ago, anyone who got training a year ago, they should all be on the same page now. We also have a specific general order in regards to that, and you pretty much, it's not just based on pulse. Again, I don't know exactly when this case was, but we've had changes to policy where unless there's like rigor mortis or it's like obviously that she's gunshot trauma to the entire head, then we normally call meds in to declare that. So I'll let Lieutenant De La Osa talk about when this happened and then if the policy changes have happened before or after that.
So in this case, it happened in 2021. And going back to what Chief Duffy was saying, and Lieutenant De La Osa, Tucson Police, and signed Operation Vision Midtown. In this case, it can get chaotic because, first of all, we have Customs Border Patrol there and then Pima County Sheriff's there who definitely called Tucson Police to get there. We get there, and it does, the way it goes is the person who is incident command is the first officer people need to get there. So in reading the case, it does show that the Pima County Sheriff deputy had checked the pulse and declared the person deceased at 11:02, 23:02 hours. The TPD officer and their trainee get there. The trainee had also, and I don't know if this was a training opportunity because what we try to do with our field trained officers is to get our new officers as much training as we possibly can. So I don't know if that's what happened with the new trainee. And you're supposed to have with your two fingers, the radio, the throttle. He had used his thumb, I guess, and you're not supposed to use your thumb because you can really make a heartbeat. And that was the actual, when him saying that he had a heartbeat on that. However, it would be appropriate if one, if even one officer, if he had done it wrong and said, I think I feel a heartbeat, I think the correct thing to do was maybe get Tucson Fire to check. But I don't know the circumstances. They did talk about how the legs were mangled and that there was blood from the back of the head. And I see what you're saying. If the heart's still pumping, it would still be going. But Officer Hoffman had explained in the report that there was also rigidity and explained to where the blood was at the bottom.
But the policy has changed since then. So literally, I mean, unless rigidity has set in or there's some obvious to someone who has zero training that this person is deceased, then Tucson Fire is called to pronounce. And there's been updated CPR training, so everyone's on the same page. Everyone knows, wrist here or neck, and you have to do it for a certain time period. So mm-hmm. That has all been updated. It sounds like that was in 2021. Everyone got training in 2022. We put everybody over the years on the same page since CPR and the different training has changed over the years.
I do recall reading that TFD was called to the incident, and it was SO that said, that declared him, but that SO wasn't on duty, I don't believe.
Yeah, I read that. So the notice of claim that was submitted, granted, I've worked for a bunch of attorneys in town. Some of them were personal injury, and some of them have filed notices of claim with government agencies, and what I'm used to seeing is way more substantive than that one-page document that was submitted as a notice of claim. And just because I'm nosy, is there an outcome to that? For like $200,000 or something?
$150,000.
For the loss of?
$150,000.
Yeah.
So, if I may, Madam Chair,
yes, absolutely.
Board members, generally what happens is if we receive a notice of claim in the city attorney's office, that's handled by the risk management. They will open a file, they will review and then contact the appropriate departments, including the city attorney's office. I don't handle those particular notices of claim, but I usually risk management is the sort of manager of those notices, so I couldn't tell you what the outcome of that particular one is.
Okay.
But that's how it goes, at least generally.
Interesting. And the only other thing is that caught my eye initially was between the date of the collision and the date of the notice of claim, there's a many, many months time lapse. So regarding the interviews of the officers, I'm amazed that they were able, I mean, just given the amount of work that you guys do and the amount of contacts, that they were able to relay information. And it seems like that interview, because of the interview that was, seems like the officers were found at fault based on what was said at the interview. It's like, how reliable is that? With the amount of time change or the time lapse kind of thing. It's like, it's not a criticism of the the penalty. It's just, it's curious that interviews 6 months later on a very particular yet traumatizing, one of many traumatizing events, no doubt. How do you guys sort through the information? And knowing that, you know, people's minds jumble up stuff. Anyway, I'll quit talking about that.
So if I may to discuss that one, that's, first of all, that's part of the job that police officers are expected to do and trained to do. I just recently had a trial for a DUI that I was involved in 2018, and I had court a few months ago from that. So that's why we write case reports before we call an officer in to interview them, except for a use of force case. The officers are provided their case report, they're provided their body-worn camera footage, and they're provided all that stuff for them to review to be able to refresh their memories, and then they can always refer back to that in the interview. If we ask them a question that they don't necessarily remember, they can refer back to their case report and whatnot to refresh their memories to be able to speak to it.
Excellent. And that's all I have.
So I had a couple of questions as well. Did it say anywhere in there how many years Hoffman and Weinberg had? Because I didn't see that. That says how many years they've been on the force.
I saw that in the event chronology, but there was nothing.
And it should say, we're looking right now, but it should say in the personnel report that was written by the OPS investigator at the beginning of the interview, it normally says when they were hired.
Normally,
I believe she was hired in January of 2018. The only reason I know that is because that was my last class at the academy as an instructor out there. So, I would say January of 2018. I'm sure they'd be able to find it, but I'm pretty sure it's accurate.
Yeah, normally in the beginning of the report, that second or third page tells you where they're working, how long they've been working, was this an off-duty incident and stuff like that, and I didn't see it in that where in there for either one of them. So then I want to make sure I'm clear with the attorney. The city, you say risk management takes on whether they're going to pay for missing items or not?
Right. If there's a claim for items or property damage of some sort, then they would manage that claim. If it's going to litigation, then they would handle it.
Did the wallet ever show up? Do we know if the wallet ever show up?
The wallet was never found. Embarrassed to say that does happen a little too often, where we do leave a wallet or an ID on top of the hood when you drive away. We are looking at different types of, to remedy that situation, there's a toolbox. There's a magnetic toolbox that we're looking into where it goes on the side of the police car, so when somebody is going through somebody's pockets, they don't just leave the items on top of the back of the hood. So we are working on a couple of things to remedy that. We did not locate the wallet. In the report, Officer Hoffman and LPO Utter went back to the area and drove slowly to see if we can try to find that wallet.
January 5th. 2018 is our date.
For Hoffman?
For Hoffman. And Weinberg was September 16th of 2016. It's been like 5 years ago.
And it's coming in that training phase, right?
Any other thoughts, questions?
Just, yes, I do. Yes. Thank you. Just a couple of observations, and I don't mean to be a backseat driver here. In that kind of an instance, I would actually have TFD call it versus PD calling it, because I know I've been around incidences where PD has called a death and fire has not, and they've not been transported. And from an optics perspective, it would have looked better to have TFD call someone deceased and take them to the hospital. And I know you go through this very often, but that just a thought.
I mean, pretty much the current policy dictates, unless they're, you know, or other than, you know, half the body is, you know what I mean, elsewhere.
Yeah, oh, I understand that.
Other than that, is what the current policy dictates.
Yeah, okay.
To be on the same side.
Yeah, I think this one just didn't really take that. They made the call and then went with it. I think it was really sort of an experience at that point, in my opinion.
Can I ask one more question? Are TPD and the Sheriff Department on completely different pages as far as their policies and procedures?
I'm not sure about, I haven't reviewed all their policies, but I mean, we train completely separate. They have a separate training academy from the beginning. We don't do any annual training together, and so I haven't reviewed their policies recently to see how similar or unsimilar they are to ours, but.
Because I think I saw somewhere in the reading that TPD is not, that officers are not allowed to call a person deceased unless, like, their head is decapitated or, like you say, rigor mortis has set in or something. So I was just wondering if the Sheriff Department is on that same page, or they're allowed to say a person's deceased without calling the fire department. That's a question.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Again, our policy was changed because it said obvious, and we figured out that obvious to some people is not obvious to others, which is why we were super specific.
Right.
So I'm not sure exactly how theirs reads currently, but I can definitely find out and give you the update for next time.
I would say that I think I did recognize that they did do real concerted effort to find the pulse. I mean, they spent a good amount of time actually trying. So I would say kudos to that.
Mm-hmm.
Jaime, anything?
I think I had the same questions this morning.
Okay. Well, if there are no other questions, then I will entertain a motion on case number 21-0416.
I move to find OPS, case OPS 21-0416 to be found fair and thorough.
Second.
Thank you. We have a motion by Martha Lemon to approve case 21-0416 as found to be fair and thorough, and second by Kate Calhoun. Can we have roll call, please?
Jaime Tadeo.
Aye.
Annabelle Nunez.
Aye.
Kate Calhoun.
Aye.
Tracy Hockett.
Aye.
And Martha Lemon.
Aye.
Thank you, Renee. Okay, case number 21-0536. This is the case of failure to provide appropriate services. The incident took place at an apartment complex. It was very involved. There were a number of people that were involved in the case. The complainant, in summary, the complainant advised officers not to let him secure his property, and the officers mishandled the incident, causing him to lose his clothes and furniture. So the complainant was, I believe, detained as they found out there was a warrant in Tennessee. And so, and essentially they were called out to the site, I believe, because there was a physical altercation and people trying to determine who was living where and what. And I think my estimation was they didn't obtain the information as to who was living where and what, and so that made it difficult to sort of maybe collect information on the property. But long story short, that was found to be sustained at the blue level, and the action that was provided, or the discipline, was a restorative supervision. And there was one officer that was involved. Open it up for discussion.
So I'll start on this one.
Yes, thank you, Tracy.
I'd like to ask, when they say restorative supervision, that maybe they could improvise on that, because sometimes I'm wondering, what kind of a restorative supervision? Did you just sit them down and say, we don't do that, or what? But it might be nice to know what kind of restorative supervision took place. That's just my idea. But I'd also like to know, what did the officers do to deem, I'm not sure I understood what they did to deem Mr. Flores had the authority to give them permission to conduct the preserve the peace, I guess is what I'm saying. Because after looking at the video, I was so confused. I was like, okay, how do you know who lived where, whose stuff is what? And so I'm not exactly sure what made them give permission for people to just start going to remove stuff. Is there a way that they can reach landlords that actually let them know who lives in places? And I know that's kind of it, because if a person stays there, gets mail there, this and that, you know, so, but is there any kind of policy that, you know, when you're in these kind of situations, before you just go letting people have stuff, that you confirm with the landlord or something of who actually has their names on the lease?
And I can speak with that. So a lot of these civil compromises or civil disputes that we have, landlords, most of the time or some of the time, doesn't even know that there's another person's property in there. In this case, it was the neighbor's. She kept some of her clothes and property there. She had basically told the officers, I have my stuff in there, can I get it back? If there's no contention from the actual renter or the person that's actually leasing there, we will let that property go. However, in this case, going back to the furniture, the sofa, a person was in custody and told the officer, hey, that's my couch, I paid for it. That officer failed to relay that information to the other officers who were actually trying to figure out whose property belonged to what. So that's where he was found sustained for that a customer service policy. What officers more or less do in these situations, they try to see whose property belongs to what. If we cannot prove that property needs to go with them, and if we don't have a landlord that can say otherwise, well, we as a police department will say, well, that property stays here until you can prove that that property is yours. But it really sounds, in court, you saw the body worn camera, it's almost like a free for all. Everybody was, well, that's mine, that belongs to me, this belongs to me. So it was a little bit chaotic there for the officer.
So did I also read that the officers gave the neighbor the keys to his apartment in the end?
The keys were given to the neighbor.
To the gentleman who was in custody, his keys were given to the neighbor. Was that? That was correct? On page 5, and I didn't put which, what page 5, but it looks like it read that the officers gave the neighbor, which I'm assuming is the young lady who had her stuff in his place, the keys to his place, which didn't make any sense to me at all.
I don't know if there was a discussion that was, because her property was there inside the residence, so I don't know if that was allowed by the actual person who stays there.
Okay. And then I had one more question, and I'm done for the whole day.
Please,
I didn't understand why the female officer on the scene, it seemed like when the male officer arrived, she began to explain to him, I guess, the situation, but she knew it. I didn't understand that. It didn't really make any sense to me. She unmuted after they were back over there with the two young ladies sitting down. But he came on the scene, it was her. She had one young lady. The other female officer had another young lady at the bottom of the steps. And when the male officer came up, she began to explain what's going on and immediately muted her body-worn cam. So I didn't understand that process.
I think that typically happens, right? But they mute when it's discussion between officers and will unmute when they're in the presence of.
But about the case?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I thought I was under the impression that when they were away from the case, they may mute because they may discuss other things that have nothing to do with the case, but okay.
Yeah, it's a curious question. I mean, it's a good question because it's like, would that be helpful for, say, us as reviewers to be in on the conversation? You know, but I don't know what the privilege is of muting between the officers.
A lot of time, it can be personal. I mean, I've done that before. We've gotten the scene, and I'll be like, what's going on here? And I go, we've got to unmute. Hey, I got to go to the bathroom real quick. You know, something personal with that effect that has nothing to do with the investigation. It'll be among two officers. Hey, can you have this scene? Because I got to run the restroom or something.
Or I'll even give another example. Say the two officers, they come together, what do you have? And they're discussing it, and they might have a disagreement initially, and certainly until you come to an agreement, whether it's with a sergeant or you talk through it, I mean, defense attorneys would be all over that. All you have to do is say at one point one officer wasn't sure, and so really it's to discuss the case and come to an understanding, review everything. The policy just says that with the public, you have to have it unmuted and on once you have contact with the public. So it has happened. I mean, obviously, people need to turn them off and mute them. They don't when they go to the restroom or when they're doing other things. And so there is exclusions in the policy. But so it's kind of twofold. It's for that because you're discussing something else, possibly, or it could be that you're discussing all the facts of the case and coming to your conclusion.
Would there ever be an instance where, well, they've muted, so that's a moot point. Okay, never mind. I'm going to return to something. I'll get to this third case. Okay. Any other comments, questions, discussion on case number 21-0536.
In response to Tracy's question.
Oh, yes.
Restorative supervision might mean what? Anybody vote yes or comment on that? The definition of restorative.
So restorative supervision can be a mix of things. It can be, as you said, Tracy, it could be just a sit down and verbal counseling, don't do that again. It could be a PPR, which is a written document that goes. It stays with the employee supervisor for years, so if they're when the supervisor writes the evaluation of that employee. It could be retraining. You know, I could say, hey, say it's a collision, and this is, I could say, hey, I want you to go out to the academy, and I want you to do a couple hours of backing training because you backed into this pole. So it's a mix of different things available to supervisors to try to retrain the employee to have that action not happen again. So it's something that we use when it doesn't rise to the level of discipline. Restorative supervision is not considered discipline. It's retraining an employee.
but it is tracked in the division. So say, for example, they've got they had a sit-down talk, or they got the PPR, and they do the same thing 3 months later, then it ups the discipline. It becomes progressive. Instead of being, you know, restorative, we're trying to train you, like, now you've done this twice. So it's going to change the level. So it is still tracked in the divisions, even though it's technically not discipline on paper, you know what I mean, for them to grieve or to fight, but it is still tracked. There is some sort, it's normally in the form of a PPR written, so it can be referred to.
I think we saw that in one of the cases where they had...
In this case itself, there's a PPR. It's on file.
Is this the same officer we're speaking of? Sorry, I don't have the perfect recall on this, but I do remember saying that they did go back and look, and so that made the determination of what the outcome was going to be, right, on the action.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I thought you...
Oh.
On this one, he did get a PPR, so his restorative was actually a written documentation.
Okay.
A one-page document saying...
Which was the case that there was history for the police officer? There was something went back to 2018. There was another one.
There's been a couple, I thought.
One of the officers in one of the cases that we just reviewed.
Yeah. Okay. So if it was considered that far back, it wouldn't have been restorative, because restorative supervision can only be considered back 1 year. And Assistant Chief Duffy said, that would be, hey, you just got in a collision 3 months ago. You were given a PPR saying be more careful when you back up. You just backed into something again. Now you're going to get disciplined.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, so it was like a year term? Is that what? Okay, okay.
Yeah, it varies depending on what level of, in the matrix, you know, yellow, blue. So the timelines vary depending on
that,
but blue is one year.
Okay.
Okay. Any other discussion on this case, 2105? 36. I'm going to entertain a motion on.
Do you want to not
meet anyone?
I'll move.
Okay.
I move to find case 21-0536 to be found fair and thorough.
I'll second that. All right. So we have a motion by Martha Lemon to. Find case 21-0536 fair and thorough. And Annabelle Nunez, second the motion. Roll call, please.
I'm Mitadeo.
Aye.
Annabelle Nunez.
Aye.
Kate Calhoun.
Aye.
Tracy Hockett.
Aye.
And Martha Lemon.
Aye.
Great. Final case, number 22-0107. This is the case where the officers came up upon two individuals at a bus stop. Male individual was, and who sent in the complaint, was upset that he had been detained and that he would like the officer's supervisor to discuss patience with him. And in this case, the officers were investigating a missing girl report, and the individual that was with the complainant was fit the description of the individual that had been reported as missing. So the allegation is failure. It's 201, failure to take appropriate action. There was no violations found, so there was no action on this case. Any discussion?
The only thing I have on this, I was fully prepared to roll my eyes at when I read the description that describes the officer or supervisor needs to discuss patients. The only thing I was fully prepared to roll my eyes at, just like, come on. But when you read it, the complainant does have a little bit of a point, kind of thing. It's, and that's all I have about that. So I don't know if it's lack of patience or if it's all that the officer experienced that day, which resulted in what seems to be
a lack of patience at that moment in time. Who knows? But whatever happened, or the complaint seems valid, and I support whatever outcome, or I support the outcome of this case at the same time. All of that to say, I recognize how hard and stressful your job is. It's a wonder you guys don't lose your minds daily, so.
We do.
That's a compliment. It is, and I think the follow up with the individual was, you know, we'll relay the message. And I think there was a request, you want us to get back with you, and there was an offer to really legitimately follow up and sort of maybe have that conversation with the officer, let the individual know how that went forward. So I think the effort was done in clear conscience. So. Any other discussions, comments, thoughts on case 22-0107? All right, I'll entertain a motion from anyone.
I so move.
Thank you, Ms. Tracy Hockett. Do I have a second?
A second.
Jaime, beat you, honey. All right.
I guess I'll second.
Thank you, Jaime. We have a motion by Tracy Hockett to find case 22-0107. To be clear, fair, and thorough, and a second by Jaime Tadeo. Thank you. Roll call, please.
Jaime Tadeo.
Aye.
Annabelle Nunez.
Aye.
Kate Calhoun.
Aye.
Tracy Hockett.
Aye.
And Martha Lemon.
Aye.
Thank you. All right. Let's try to get through elections very quickly. So it's time to. Thank you so much. Appreciate that so much. It's time to find two new officers for 2023. I have been your chair for a very long time. I'm sure you're ready for some new leadership, some new excitement, maybe some new perspective on how these meetings are run. And I will say I appreciate Ms. Kate Calhoun, who is willing to serve as chair. And I don't know if anyone else is interested. Does anyone want to self-nominate to be chair?
I've been vice.
You what?
I've been vice.
And you were vice chair? You want to stay as vice?
No.
Do you want to be chair?
No. I don't have the capacity for, like, to take that type of commitment. I mean, I have to bring my brother in.
Thank you, Jaime. Thank you for serving as vice chair for me.
You could also be vice chair.
Yeah.
I can nominate you as vice chair.
I'll take it if no one else is chomping at the bit. Tracy, vice chair interest? Chair interest. Martha, vice chair interest?
No, thank you.
Okay. Annabelle, vice chair interest? Sure. All right. I'm willing to do it. So the slate looks as such. Thank you, Kate, for agreeing to take on the chairperson role, and I am happy and would be honored to work with you as your vice chair. Having said that, let's have a motion to approve the slate of Kate Calhoun and Annabelle Nunez as Kate Calhoun as chair, Annabelle as vice chair for the upcoming year for CPAR.
I'll make that motion.
Thank you, Martha.
I second.
All right, let's go ahead and have a roll call.
Jaime Tadeo.
Aye.
Annabelle Nunez.
Aye.
Kate Calhoun.
Aye.
Tracy Hockett.
Aye.
And Martha Lemon.
Aye.
Terrific. Thank you. Thanks so much, Kid. I appreciate that.
Madam Chair, just for clarification, it's not so much that anybody would want to change because you've done a super job.
Right.
Our ordinance does not allow you to sit more than two consecutive 1-year terms.
Correct. Thank
so
you.
So that's the reason this is happening. You've only sat for two consecutive.
Through COVID.
You feel it.
Thank you. I think it added about two more gray hair in this lot here. So, and I want to really thank you, Mitch, for all your guidance in the time that I've been chair. Sincerely appreciate you know, really reinforcing what needs to get done and reminding me kindly on so many occasions. And I would assume that you would extend the same support to Kate as well. So thank you so much.
Okay.
I appreciate that. All righty. Item number 7, police, Tucson Police Department, in accordance with provision of the state open public meeting law. There are items that are listed on the agenda in order to allow TPD to present a brief summary of current events pursuant to provisions of the ARS section 30.
So current event updates I have for you is the police department has finally met and done a strategic plan because we are pulled in 100 different directions and we just don't have the staffing to do so. So the two of our department goals that affect patrol, which is the bureau that I represent, is violent crime overall. So creating a strategy, but really working together with our partners, with detectives, all having the same goals together. So we're not just, I mean, we're working in specific locations like our P&I locations and high volume locations. And then the other one is the opioid epidemic, which affects numerous things. Homeless, property crime, a lot of things. So that's kind of like the higher level, and then it actually, quality of life comes into play there. And so we are working with our federal partners on the amount of fentanyl and things that are coming here, but more so, I mean, obviously our approach is twofold. It's with deflection, but it's also when necessary, because in some encampments, some folks that choose to be homeless haven't been able to remain there because of the level of violence that has been going on in some of those. And so on the other part, it is the criminal aspect and holding those accountable that aren't making it safe, even for the folks that want to remain in homeless camps. So it's kind of addressing the opioid epidemic from the dealer standpoint, the folks that are dealing locally, and then getting the supply across the border and what we can do to try and prevent that in that time, but also getting folks into treatment who are ready for treatment. So those are two of our 7 goals. Some of the others are recruiting and retaining, focusing on grant funding, but that really supports the department and the department goals, not necessarily getting grants that we can't work because we don't have the staffing, but really being strategic in how we focus our efforts on things with staffing. The other is hiring professional staff, so we're hoping eventually to bring back some officers that left the department but want to come back and work in a civilian capacity that can take on other duties. So anything we can to try and free up the officers in the field for the community so we can provide more community support, we're working on different things. Work in progress.
Thank you, Chief.
So
any questions?
Yes,
absolutely.
How is that targeting crime areas? Like, I think you guys were working on 22nd and Prudence, maybe.
Yes, still doing
that. Is that working?
Yeah, so actually, it's been almost a 40% reduction in that area. And so it's kind of the whole area, but it's really that. We have 3 of those projects working, one in Midtown, one out east, and one down south, and it's really working on the network. Because we tend to find that the folks that are creating issues there are also creating issues in Midtown, and then they make their way to, you know, the Operation South. And so it's creating the networks and going after the key players that keep repeat offending in different divisions versus, you know, running to jail with a first-time offender who's going to be out in 3 hours, but it's focusing on the networks, the folks that are causing the most issues throughout the city, and putting those together. So we've seen good successes. It's working with the city in its entirety, so it's like working with housing and doing a variety of issues, code enforcement. So it's not just a police response, but it's like, is the apartment complex drawing certain people in, and why? Is there a different behavior that they're displaying, or what are they doing? So it's working really well. We have a monthly meeting on that, and we have seen a 40% decrease in those areas.
Wow. Good. That's good.
Yeah.
How's recruiting going?
So It's about the same all over the world. I just came back from major city chiefs, and we're not many departments offer like a $15,000 signing bonus, and they still struggle with signing bonus. So we are still running 3 academies a year. We're changing some. So part of the strategic plan is a recruiting effort, like really digging deep, like what is bringing the folks to our department? Where do we need to start? Do we need to start early in the schools and then kind of work them through our pipeline and make sure we're mentoring them? So we're looking at like what's working, why officers are coming here, and then what we need to do to properly recruit folks to come in, like how early do we have to start? And so we are still doing 3 academies a year, normally about 20 officers for TPD in each one, but obviously we'd like to increase that. And then we're still doing community service officers, and we're doing 3 of those a year too. So those are super, the community service officers are super helpful, and we're expanding the calls that they can take. They're getting that training this month. And so they'll be able to take on some of the workload again, which would free up the officers for, you know, the higher level priority calls, but still provide the customer service that we want to the community.
Other questions? Sure.
If somebody forgets to pay a parking ticket in California, is that going to like warrant here in Arizona?
I have never seen one in my 22 years evolved out of a parking ticket, so I just don't think so. I don't know that it wouldn't be a warrant in California. I've never seen one here, and honestly, I don't know that it would transpire into that. And we certainly wouldn't, they normally wouldn't actually get, like, take someone back to California for
California. I'm asking for a friend.
Yeah. California won't even extradite their felons because they just want them to stay out of California. So even if
someone did, we wouldn't do anything with it because they would have to be willing to come and pick you up. And according to Lieutenant Cornia, they won't even come pick up the violent felons.
There were so many people that I ran into that had like armed robbery felony warrants out of California, and they would only extradite within the state of California.
There's several charges there as well.
I think the question came from, like, I heard that the relevance between California and Arizona are like, talking to each other about, like, saying that.
I don't know.
Do you think it might have to do just because of so many Californians moving to Arizona?
You need a rival?
Like, you know, we don't need the bad guys.
Just to put in the context of what Chief Duffy was saying too, just to add a little bit more to it. I mean, when I've been on since 2006, and there's people here in the room that have been on longer than I have. When I tested against 1,500, 2,000 people. And for a number of years now, we've been struggling to get over 200 people to show up. Yeah, so we're definitely not getting the same pool of people to swipe from. So that's the problem. Just the general disinterest of doing his job.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the last 5 years of just really world events and just social events.
What's
part of
it?
But I think in general, I work at the U of A.
So it's improved. It's normally, we've graduated most of the class. If they normally quit, it's in the first or second week. And we've even changed how we've done the first few weeks. Like, it's no stress. We kind of work them into the physical fitness. But if they quit the first 2 weeks, it's one because they didn't know that in this job, I'm not kidding you, I've actually had a few that say, I didn't know I was going to have to arrest anyone.
Wow.
Yes. And then the others have had some sort of family issue go on, and their family hears for them, and they're young. Most of the applicants are fairly young, so the training has changed. We have adapted our training, I mean, to include down to like teaching people how to talk to someone, because having kids at that age, they're texters, and so forcing them to have a conversation with family members, let alone strangers, is a challenge. So So, yeah. But once, if we get them through the academy, we actually lose more in field training, which is 17 weeks of training with other officers.
Well, and I was always surprised about the driving, right? Like how many issues you were having to bring people back for some redos with just driving because they had just gotten their license.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, that's pretty fascinating. But I think, you know, we have to stay ahead of the curve in terms of like this younger up and coming generation. It's just a whole different, you know. People aren't working for TikTok. I mean, it's like, I know the university, we're having a hard time hiring in general, you know, so maybe the city's the same. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's all different, right? Any other questions for TPD? Thank you again, Chief Duffy, for being here, as well as our officers back here. Thank you so much. Let me see, Office of Professional Standards. Anything?
That would be. Actually, I'm going to step over here so you guys can see
me. Awesome.
Back so, for those that don't know me, I'm Tim Reese, and I'm going to sit down so I don't stand over you guys. I'm the new captain in internal affairs, and I replaced Joe Puglia at the first of the year. So, this is pretty exciting times because not only is it new for me, new assignment, but it's also new with CPARP coming back to in-person meetings and really kind of, I know you guys have been doing a really good job of meeting virtually and just kind of getting through as many cases as you could. Well, now we're going to be back in person and kind of getting back to a sense of normalcy or whatever. So that's the biggest change in OPS. The staff, it's pretty much the same as far as the staff you've been working with or you've seen some of the cases come through, the same detectives, same supervisors. The only constant in life is change, so we're getting ready to, okay, what's going to happen? Because I have a couple people that have done very well on promotional processes, and they may end up promoting at some point in the next couple of years. And so we have to kind of groom the next people. In fact, we have some different supervisors and things that come in. They'll do a day with us, but we'll sit with OPS for half a day to a day to kind of learn, okay, what's this job all about? So we can kind of make sure that it's a good fit so that when we do have an opening, we're not left scrambling to find somebody. So the training, most of our staff's really trained up. The only one that's kind of rookie and green is me. So I'm actually currently going to the Daigle training for internal affairs. I did my first day. That was wonderful. The beating, no, it's all by virtual stuff, so it was pretty long and dry, but it's really good information. So I should be done with that by the time our next meeting comes around. But no, I just want to say thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to this next year and seeing kind of what CPARP, you know, what it's looking like. And now that Kate, you're taking over the helm, anxious to see. We are taking parking violations very seriously, so
might ship them back to California.
Just kidding. Actually, any questions for me? Been doing this job for kind of a long time. That's why I have all the gray hairs. So next month will be 28 years. So it's been a while. I've got about a little over 2 years left in the drop. So I'll be here and talk with the chief and deputy chief. I think the plan is for me to stay through there. And I'm actually pretty happy in internal affairs. Don't tell the chief's office this, ma'am. It's like the briar patch because they move you when you're happy. Because it's something new. I've never been in internal affairs. I was never an investigator. Never had a lot of discipline. So never in internal affairs. So I'm learning something new every day, and no 2 days are the same, so that's kind of exciting stuff. So, but I do have a pretty open door policy, and Mitch and I are talking all the time. So if you ever have any questions or any issues, don't hesitate to reach out. But otherwise, I'll see you guys next month.
Thank you, Captain.
Captain, real quick. One of the things that you're doing also is doing ride-alongs. Is that right? If you could maybe explain why that was.
Sure, absolutely. The chief's office, we are doing patrol ride-alongs as an agency, all commissioned officers. If you're not in a primary patrol assignment, if you're a detective, if you're an investigator, even in internal affairs, we're going out and actually doing a ride in patrol once a quarter. We're trying to shoot for once a month at a minimum, or not at a minimum, at like a maximum, no more than that. But at minimum, we want you to try and get out there once a quarter. It's not for the idea of being able to go out there and just shag calls and be a force multiplier immediately. It's more of a case of to help a better understanding of really what's going on in patrol. How busy are they? What are some things that we can train each other on? So it's really good when investigators, detectives are able to sit there and say, no, if you write the case this way, these are the important things that help prosecute the case. It makes the officers work better. It makes the detectives work better. and the detectives get a little bit more perspective of what it's really like in patrol right now. And so that is for all patrol. Even the chief was out here on a ride, so even she's done it. I'm set up, I'll be going next month. Jesse, Lieutenant Corney, is already gone, so even internal affairs, which it is kind of fun whenever internal affairs shows up to a briefing, they're like, what are you guys doing here?
Yeah.
Going for a ride, want to do police work. So, yeah, and that's one thing that the chief's office really, we want to make sure that it's not about silos on the department anymore. You don't have investigations here, patrol here, because that just, we don't have enough people to do that, and it's more importantly, it's ineffective. So that's really what we're doing. So,
that's great to know.
Do you have anything to add on that, chief, on the patrol rides? Anything to add on that?
No, I mean, so initially it was set up to have additional folks ready in case they needed to get in uniform and they felt comfortable. I mean, there's always changes going on. But like Captain Reese said, more importantly, it's about the mentorship. One, the senior detectives and senior officers, et cetera, will learn something from the newer generation of new patrol officers. But they also have a lot of knowledge and wealth of knowledge that they can offer the officers about crime scene management and case reports or just the little things that we see missing in here that you all discuss that we would like to see a little bit better. I mean, even just communicating to make sure they follow through on things and that type of stuff. Definitely watching a senior officer. We have a really young agency in patrol, and so it's, in some cases, I mean, you know, really young officers training other officers, leading other officers. So it's really good for them to have senior leaders, supervisors, detectives on the field out there kind of showing them. And also, I mean, where we've been around so long, we don't tend to get super hyped up on things. So it's good for them to watch how someone remains calm and just works through things. And so I'm going to try and do it once a month.
Well, and it removes that.
I'm going to try not to get a complaint that you guys are
going to
leave you here.
But it removes that sort of stigma of like the us and them within your own organization,
absolutely.
Right? And sort of those power, you know,
like the chief
structures.
Said, really, there's a mentorship level where a newer officer may be like, why am I doing this? This is dumb. Why am I doing this small administrative task with this case? Well, the detective can answer that and say, well, actually, here's why. Because it makes their job 50 times easier when we go to issuing or we go to for something else. So. There's a really good level of mentorship, and you know, as much as you know, there may be a little bit of whining and gnashing of teeth sometimes with change, and when people are saying you have to do certain things, I think a lot of the officers I've talked to that have gone back, the detectives, they're actually kind of enjoying it. It's kind of a nice, you wouldn't call it a break, but it just kind of recharges you a little bit, so it's fun.
Well, and through the eyes of
new folks,
Tracy.
I had a terrible ride along.
Oh no!
My driver was horrible. He liked looking at the stolen cars. I was just like, you know, this is what you're out here doing. There's got to be something better than this, you know. But,
Must have worked in an area where there's a lot of that kind of activity going on. But
not sure. He was pulling up on cars. I'm like, see, if I'm the driver of this car and just running their license plate, you know, I'm like, that would scare the heck out of me as a civilian. You ride up on my car the way he was riding up on cars, only to run and say, okay, we're fine. People are moving. I'm like, how are you even picking these cars? You're rolling up on, you know? It was a wild meeting. 4 hours, I think.
4 hours?
Yeah, I think I was like, please give me that.
Well, that's curious to me, because then I would ask the question, like, what determines how you roll up on a car? Is there a list that
I'm an African-American woman in the car with a police officer. I was not going to ask no questions. And honestly, this board has allowed me that, this one and the force review board has allowed me to be more open than I would have ever been one-on-one with a police officer.
So,
to answer your question, that is, like, we'll get trends of, hey, these are the cars that are more easily stolen, you know, like older Hondas are really easy with the digital keys to steal, or F-250s because they don't use the chip, they don't have the immobilizer chip, even the newer ones, because they're usually fleet vehicles. And then, you know, if there's a common car in the division where the detective unit in that division will say, hey, we've seen an uptick of thefts of Hyundai Sonatas from this year to this year. And then they get that out to patrol, so then it's something you can keep your eyes out for as you're driving around. You're like, hey, there's a Hyundai Sonata right there. Let me run the license plate, see if it's stolen.
It's like me when I would be on a vacation trip and I would be looking for the bug because you were, what was it, Beetle? What was the game you did when you were? What was it? Slug bug. Yeah. It stays in your brain, right?
Yeah.
So I would imagine maybe that's a little bit of that. But I'm glad to hear you went on a ride along. I think, you know, those are back in motion then, right? That we're able to do.
Absolutely.
So I encourage the committee to think of do that. I did one in the before times and it was kind of cool. So take advantage of that.
All right, any other questions for me?
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
All righty. And thanks for being here. You're welcome to stick around or take off and get some nice chow. Item number 8 on the agenda, Office of the Independent Police Auditor. Mitch, thanks.
I have a few things to talk about very quickly. And first thing, oh, this is going to feel so good. These are your certificates for completing your 80 hours.
Oh.
Well done.
All right, Kay.
Well done.
All right,
well
thank
done.
You.
All right. Cool.
So congratulations. That's good. That really is quite the achievement. Statewide, not many people have been able to do that. So excellent.
Thank you.
Good job, good job, good job. TPD put a lot of work into preparing that for you and monitoring it. It really was a huge task, so thank you for that. Speaking of training, that's from last year. Guess what? Now it's a new year, 2023. So, yeah. So now you have to try, I forget the words, in the ordinance, try for 40 hours of training for this year.
Up to 40 hours.
You don't have to get it, but you have to endeavor to pursue or any way that's worded, which means just make an effort. So ride along is another suggestion. Certainly for you, if you haven't done it in a while and you probably haven't, you might want to do that again. So think about that, and trainings that you have here will count toward that requirement as well. Just make sure that you capture it and turn it into Kate so she can keep track. All right, so that's the training. Along the lines with these certificates, I'm going to ask again, talk to your council office, your ward office, talk to your council members. If you know anybody, because you go to parties and some of this may come up, guess what I do? And it just would. If you have anybody that's interested, or if your ward office has anybody that's interested, get the name. And I'm going to get them going on that 80 hours as well, that training, so they can slide in and they can start right away, even before the hours are done, and be an advisory member.
Non-voting advisory.
You don't need to go through mayor and council for that. You guys can select your own advisory members. So those are people that can participate in full, they just cannot vote, and they have access to the records and be able to look at the same things you do. And then when there's a change or someone wants to drop off here, you're going to have somebody else can slide in if the ward office wants to appoint that person. So please, you need people in the shoot, or, you know, there's two people now, there's no court. And efforts are still being made with the wards that have yet to select somebody. So we'll see what that may mean. This year, how many folks are up for re-election? There's quite a few, right?
It's a mayoral election, so it's mayor, 1, 3, 4, yeah.
That's
a lot.
Wow.
And so please, if you want to see this board sustained, please make the effort. And you guys know it better than anybody else. So if you know anybody that's interested, or again, pressure your ward office or just discuss it with them gently. And just see if there's anybody else they might want to bring on board. So thank you for that. That's really important. Another training opportunity that's going on is, you've heard me talk about NACOLD before, National Association for Civilian Oversight and Law Enforcement. The annual conference this year will be November 12th through 16th in Chicago. And it's called Building Better Oversight. If you're interested, you can see if there's a way possibly to offset your expenses. Chicago in November. I still have three coats that take up two closets. They're my New York coats, so I will lend you a coat should you need one. But if you're interested, the agenda has not, the sessions have not yet even been announced. So I can get you more details on that as that becomes available. One of the nice things that I'm seeing with TPE in the community is I'm starting to see newsletters put out. I've seen a few from East, Operation Division East, and Operation Division South. I don't know if Midtown or West are doing them. I haven't seen them. And the ones from South and East are just really nice. They're really putting out a nice newsletter, giving information about the current goings on and some statistics as well. So they're making a real effort to connect with the community. It's excellent to see that. I'd love to see all the substations do that. If they don't already have plans to do that. Has anybody attended a DAC meeting, the DAC, the District Advisory Committee, I guess it's called? If you have not, please consider that. They're held in every single substation quarterly, or just about quarterly. It's an opportunity for the substation to open its doors. The substation is headed up by a captain who will be present, and a lieutenant at least. Maybe more than one lieutenant and present sergeant, maybe some officers. They'll have an opportunity to explain to you what's going on out of that area, and then it's an opportunity for you to share any concerns that you may have specific to that area. It's probably the best way to get the ear of TPD, very specific TPD officer.
Do they mention or like sort of keep a calendar on TPD website, like when those meetings are happening?
You know
for
what? I wish they did. I have to make phone calls, and I call each division and say, when's your next DAC meeting? And somebody says to me, when's DAC meeting? And it's usually assigned to a CSO to oversee. So they'll say, oh, hang on, well, that's going to be CSO Smith, and then CSO Smith or whoever it is will call me back right away. It's pretty easy. And what they do is they build a list of folks that are interested. And so they send out emails to everybody that had previously expressed interest or anybody that attended before and wrote their email address down. So if you're interested, certainly let me know. You can contact the substation yourself if you like. I'd be really happy to get your name on a list if that's what you like. No commitment. If you can't make it, you can't make it. If you want to know about every single one, that's fine, do that too. But certainly in the area that you reside, that you represent, it might be a good idea. I think it's a great idea. And I believe that's it. So thank you, guys.
So I'd like to commend Captain Peterson. He came to our Neighborhood Association meeting and actually bought a pamphlet that described the roles of the officers in his division over there and provided emails and phone numbers to everybody for absolutely anything that he probably would need a police officer for. He did a great presentation, Captain Mickey Peterson. Huh? He's in the South Division.
Okay.
But yeah, he did a great presentation and then passed those booklets out to everybody at the meeting, so neighbors can't say they don't know who to contact when they're having a certain issue or whatever. And I mean, it started with himself all the way down the pipeline. So I commend him for that.
And actually, all the divisions have newsletters. Yeah, so there should be one going out from every division.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that information. All right, on to item number 9, future agenda items. Open it up for suggestions. Martha Lemon.
I have a suggestion. So with the advent of recreational marijuana or recreational cannabis and, of course, medical cannabis, So I understand there are attorneys now who represent clients in cannabis DUI. So I'm curious as to the process TPD utilizes to determine impairment. It's like, is there a national standard or is there a standard to determine impairment? And is that whatever penalty, is that equally applied to medical card holders versus recreational users? So just more information on how do you guys determine cannabis impairment in particular?
That's a question for a training opportunity.
That's a training.
That can't be discussed now.
Yes.
If I may, I can just answer this last question. The last question is yes, they can, even if they have a car, they can be, if they're impaired, they shouldn't be driving a vehicle and they can be charged for that.
So I heard interesting secondhand information that's making me ask all of this. So,
sure.
So
there's a lot of that.
No, yeah.
So, yeah, in terms of training TPD to issue any kind of ticketing or whatever, is that sort of the question? Like,
The drug DUI program, I know.
Yeah.
I know who's in charge of that now.
The DRE program?
Yeah, the DRE program.
It's housed in DUI squad, I'm not sure. I was a DUI member for about 10 years. So the DUI, when it comes to the impairment for you, the question is how do you determine for impairment for cannabis versus alcohol or something else?
Mm-hmm.
The training that the officers go through, they look at divided attention tests, such as the walk, turn, one leg stand. And you will still see impairment on those, even for cannabis versus alcohol. Everyone thinks it's all just alcohol, which is the majority of our DUI arrests. When you have someone that shows impairment, the next step in that first decision of, is this person impaired, and do I have probable cause to arrest them for that? That decision to arrest is made, and then you have to figure out, okay, what's causing the impairment.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, you think it's alcohol, and you have odor of toxins, you have whatever. If you determine that there is not over the toxic, yet you still see someone that's impaired, they don't do the drug evaluation classification, which is you have special officers that are trained on DRE programs, and then they will take that impairment that they see and categorize it in 7 different categories of what like drugs do. So like all the barbiturates pretty much handle, or like CNS depressants handle it the same way. Alcohol falls into that as well. Stimulants handle it a different way. So cocaine and meth present a different way. But there's some similarities. So then they find out what it is, then they have their blood or urine testing done in a certain way, depending on what the current protocol is. And then if they have the positive result come back, then there's an additional charge of DUI that's specific to drug impairment with that metabolite in the blood. So kind of like in alcohol, you have to have a 0.08 or above.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this one, for a drug metabolite, there is no presumptive minimum. However, the state toxicology, DPS and stuff, has a certain cutoff that you have to hit in order to show positive. If it shows positive for CNS stimulant, like meth or whatever, cannabis for that category, then that means that there's a certain level that's hit, and so it would show as positive, and then that would be presented to the courts for that charge. But it's a separate charge than the impairment charge.
I'm curious as to that part. So you've been charged and you can determine, so coming from working with
and both those charges are two separate ones in the court. You have impairment charge and you have the BAC or the metabolite charge. And they are proven independently by the prosecution.
So does that satisfy?
That
or
might take care of the training. I don't know.
I've been out of DUI for a while. So I'm rusty.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Does that sort of answer any questions?
Maybe, unless I think of something else.
But if there's any other training ideas at the table today, if not, think about it. Shoot Kate an email for ideas that perhaps we can have the department come and give us something for next month.
So not a future agenda item, but did we ever decide like if a person can't be here, that it has to be hybrid? It was a lot of conversation about that last time. Did we ever come up with anything definitive on that?
So it's either all in person, everyone shows up in person, or it's all virtual.
Oh.
It's not both.
Okay.
So if, let's say, next month you guys happen to be like, not everyone can make it, can we all do it virtually? Then we can do that. But everyone needs to attend virtually.
Gotcha. How much notice do you need to change the meeting type?
We need to be posting the agenda within at least a week so that the public is aware if it'll be in person or virtual. But if we need to switch it.
So per open meeting law, the agendas have to be posted within 24 hours of the actual meeting date and time. But the sooner that you know, the better for us, then we can revise it and get it posted in well enough time so that way the public will also see that, oh, it went from in-person to virtual, so now here's the link. So the more time that you give Andy or Renee to know whether it's going to be in-person or virtual for whatever reason, the better it is, just so we stay within the realms of the open meeting law with public, with posting the public notice.
So what about getting the cases to us? Because had January meeting took place, I would have not had time to finish reviewing because we had like 13 days.
Right. Well, we don't have anything to do with the cases. That's something CPD. And so that's out of our hands.
So when we get all of that information, it's coming from TTD. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, we don't even know what
it's going to be discussed.
We don't have material. We
okay, so let me refocus my question then. Do you, how does that work?
So that's behind you, because OPS puts it out, the Office of Professional Standards puts that out. You guys choose, and then they provide you the cases.
And just to start with the conversation, I'm contacted, or the chair will be contacted, months in advance. I've picked cases for like April already.
Oh, so you're picking the cases.
I pick the cases. The chair picks the cases, and then TPD prepares them, you know, getting everything, and we've done them pretty far out in advance.
Just go ahead and run that down to me. So you all are picking the cases.
The chair picks the cases.
And you have them 3-4 months in advance to pick from?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you coming on, I'm sorry. Not looking at you.
No, that's okay. I my eyes are glossed over.
Yeah, and I'm going to be meeting with Kate, and I will meet just so that I can sort of do a little bit of an onboarding.
So who sends the cases to us?
TPD. And you've seen the name Linda Britton, I think, now, who is helping.
Yeah, because normally we have at least 30 days. You're talking about body worn cam, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 sometimes. You're talking about 180-some pages of reading sometimes. And so 13 days for people who are employed just ain't going to get it.
And so your preference is how many days?
At minimum, we need them at least 30 days in advance. So if we get it, you probably can't do 30, but if we get it the first of the month.
Give you 3 weeks.
I need it the last week of the month before.
I've worked with Gina to sort of do that. We've done like 3 months. She's given me a list, like with 3 months to pick from, and we've done that just to give them plenty of time. So I don't know who's the lead person now, if it's Linda. So I think it would, a conversation with her to set the expectation of what we would like, Kate would probably be helpful.
So our third case today, 15 days, hey, it was a breeze. It was easy, everything was close cut. But on some of these cases, they're very in depth. And I think that if we're to come here as citizens with a clean opinion of what what's taking place and how we feel about it, especially the vote on it, that we shouldn't have to rush through it, where we're skipping the body worn cam, okay, they're just riding in the car, you know, where we can actually spend the time to go through it and maybe go back through it because we missed something. Now you're reading it and it's like, okay, I didn't see that and you need to go back. So I just think that we need a fair amount of time to be able to do that. And I really think 30 days for three cases is a sufficient amount of time. I don't know for people who don't work or have plenty of time, you know, but for me, myself, I really would like to have 30 days.
So I appreciate that feedback, yeah. We'll look into that.
And March probably has already been picked. You know, March is picked. February is picked because we would have had February already in the can. So I would suspect that TPD is already working on redacting those items and doing what they need to prepare them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a matter of sort of establishing what the due date is.
So think these are January cases. To me, this is the end of February. February's cases should have been out. You know, so why did we need to wait until this meeting, or is there some rule that says we have to complete this one before we can start the next one? So February could have actually already have been out.
I guess it depends on when they're redacted and whatnot.
That's what I'm asking.
Yep.
These are good questions that I'll be prepared to come back with answers to next month.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. It helped to do the batch selection.
Mm-hmm.
Any other thoughts on future agenda items?
You're not limited to have TPD be the instructor. Just to remind
Correct.
You, it's easy, it's convenient, you say yes all the time. But, you know, you may have community members or organizations in the community that you may want to have come in and give a pitch to the board. So think about that. It doesn't always have to be the Tucson Police Department. So please consider it.
All right. And I call to adjourn the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
People can see me.
You don't care, right?
I care. I do care. Yeah. What am I doing? Volunteer.
Right.
At least a little bit of effort.
Oh, that's for the first. Can I?
It's not like a child.